Hello, it's great to have you with me. I'm Kim Clyden, former ABC radio presenter and children's book author, creating a community of people who care about children. How do we nurture creative, connected, resilient, emotionally intelligent, and empowered children? And they say it takes a village. So if you're feeling overwhelmed by the responsibility, you're not alone. We're surrounded, though, by people who can support us, your family, friends, and professionals, who all play an influential role in shaping our children. Imagine if your parents, teachers, relatives, or carers told you another story. Your life story would be completely different. I believe we can change the narrative for our children, but to do that, we need to change our story. Previously on What We Teach Our Children, we've explored the importance of creating a sense of community, contributing to something greater, feeling a sense of belonging, and building healthier cities through regenerative architecture. Why is that so important? Well, as a species, our very survival depends on us coming together cohesively to face our future. Part of our disconnect has occurred through urbanisation and commoditisation of our food production. Scientists have identified 9 Earth system thresholds, planetary boundaries that are crucial for maintaining a stable and resilient environment: climate change, biodiversity loss, biogeochemical flows, land system change, freshwater use, ocean acidification, stratospheric ozone depletion, atmospheric aerosol loading, and chemical pollution, many of which are already collapsing. Our symbiotic relationship with this planet is intrinsic to quality of life for both humans and the Earth. My guest today believes that regenerating landscapes, reconnecting people with their food and the land from which it grows, cultivates strong communities of change. Jade Miles is an author, podcaster, farmer of heritage fruits, and the CEO of Sustainable Table. Jade, how did you become so invested in regenerative farming?
I think it was probably just a natural evolution of my childhood. So I grew up as a Permy kid, and we grew pretty well all our own food. And really, I come at this from a, I call it futuresteading, but a homesteading perspective, where I think the way you interact with your landscape and know where your food comes from and find ways to connect in with your broader community with sharing food and sharing skills and seeds and community production, I think, is really powerful and potent. And I think, you know, we were doing that at scale in town until about 10 years ago, and we were running the local food co-op that we had founded following a local food system tour that we took ourselves on to Vermont in USA, which replicated or was very similar to the system that we were operating in here in terms of its geographic proximity to capital cities, the population base, the landscape, the mix between agriculture and tourism. And I at the time was working for the Regional Tourism Board, so I understood the sort of the potency and the capability of combining or intersecting the two. But we knew ultimately what we wanted to do in order to build resilience and connect more deeply with the land we were on was to scale up our orcharding production. And so we had a big network of growers and a big network of people who really trusted our intentions and, you know, the integrity behind our growing practices. So it's definitely not commodity scale, and we don't ever want it to be. We want to showcase an example of what can be done by, you know, a family scale operation that engages the support of its community. So now we have about 89 varieties of apple, quite a few kilometres of berries across about 15 different varieties of berry, about 9 varieties of pear. We did have cherries for a while, but now we don't. We have lots of biodiversity roses that are filled to the brim with flowers that are used as cut flowers for the local florist and also just for pollination and biodiversity in our own orchard. We don't use any synthetics at all in our landscape, and we spend a lot of time sitting on the earth with school kids and with workshop attendees, just kind of listening to what it has to tell us and, you know, understanding the landscape and where the patterns come from, where our water flows from, what kind of biodiversity we can see under our feet, whether things are dry, why, whether things are particularly wet or rotting, why, you know, asking all of those questions and really observing and truly interacting with the landscape that we are stewards from. Never at any point attempting to control it, but to work with it. And generally, if we have an out of balance system, we add life to that rather than take life from it. So never do we go in and just blanket spray to kill a problem. What we'll tend to do is sit with it for longer and potentially add a brood biology, or, you know, it might be an insect that is, we add more of, or a virus, but ultimately life is added so that the ecosystem can find its own natural balance. We've just started working with a couple of Montessori schools. We've run hundreds and hundreds of kids programs, but we're just about to start running a more consolidated week-long experience for kids that come at different times of the year so that they can see the impact that they're having through the things they're planting or the things they're growing or the things that they're adding, which is exciting.
Very exciting. How different, though, is the way you're farming now to the way your families farmed all those years ago?
We are first-gen farmers, so both my husband and I have come from farming backgrounds but small scale, and I, as a permaculture kid, categorically apply this same thinking. So really the permaculture framework is one that looks to put life at the centre of every decision that you make and creating an existence into perpetuity. And so all of that framework and that thinking that my family had is exactly the same as the one that we apply right now. My husband's background is he's a hydrogeo engineer, so he's a geologist, but came from a rural background, but neither of us have inherited land. So this land that we're on we're very much first-gen farmers, and we've had the freedom in that, which is not like every other farmer on this particular plateau who's inherited land and had to sort of look to the commodity system for practice approaches. We've been able to really set our framework and our decision-making tools and our creation of our path to market, and, you know, our branding and our approach to land management has been our own. We haven't had to inherit and then unlearn and relearn.
Permaculture is not just a system that you apply to farming, though. It can actually be applied to community and in so many other ways, like building and design. So why do you think it's so important to teach children some of these principles moving forward?
I think, interestingly, with children, they're easier to teach than adults, because I think, interestingly, they already know this way of being. They have a natural curiosity. They have an understanding that life is really important. They haven't yet learnt to disregard the quintessential value of all living beings, human and other than human, and they don't have to relearn it. You know, I think adults are actually harder to teach because there's a paradigm change that's required, whereas I think with kiddos, when they arrive and I ask them to take their shoes off and sit on the ground, they're doing it before I've even finished the request. You know, they're on the earth, you know, they're looking intensely at the ground and the colour of the soil and the different leaves that they're looking at and the different insects that they can see. And they're doing it naturally. Their curiosity hasn't been curbed, and their inclination and interest, genuine interest in it, is really critical. But I think allowing them to know that curiosity is just so important, and that they need to challenge status quo as they get older and sort of fit into a system that is industrialized and that's designed to suit output and the growth narrative as opposed to valuing the other than human systems. You know, they're naturally curious, they're really interested, they're really engaged, and they don't have preconceived ideas. And so taking the next generation into a way of being. And sometimes we sit down and we have lunch with the kids, and depending on the school and how big it is and how old the kids are, even looking in the lunch boxes is really telling as to what sort of family environments they're coming from. And we talk about nude food, and we talk about where they get their food from, and we talk about them, you know, understanding that they should know the farmer's name and all of these things, which isn't necessarily possible for those who are living in urban environments, but certainly getting them to think about the value and importance of knowing where your food comes from, how it was grown, how far it's come, what impact it has, you know, why blemished food is okay to eat. You know, all of those sorts of things, eating in season, it can be really simple messaging. It doesn't need to be the full complexity of the food system shared with them. But they take that home, and they share that in their households, they share it in their schools, they share it in their sports teams. You know, I think they are really good vectors of messages kiddos. And so I think, you know, they're the perfect place to begin.
I agree. If we don't reach that generational divide and shrink it soon, we're still going to keep repeating the same cycles. And one of the things you just mentioned about farmers and the urban environment, I mean, are most of our foods produced to go to cities where the populations are, and yet there's this massive disconnect. And in the 10 years I've worked with agricultural / environmental enterprises in farming, I've often asked, how do we end up at this point? So what are the greatest challenges you think we face moving forward, trying to connect farming to the consumer?
Yeah, that disconnect is real, very, very real. Look, I think ultimately our biggest challenge is cultural, and I think there is a deep disconnect from country. I'm not Indigenous, but I've spent a lot of time on country with different communities, and I ultimately think that as long as we as a species continue to believe that we can control the ecological system that is holding all of us, I think we're ultimately doomed to fail. Culturally, we need to transition back to a place where we have a deeper understanding of the system that holds us, and that we are but one of the prongs in the myriad spokes or web that is complex, that is interrelated, that is, you know, fundamental for continuation, and that has the ability to feed us, nourish us, heal us. I just think that deep disconnect to food is definitely a component of it, but I think that deeper disconnect from country is an even more important part of it. And I think there's some really simple things that we can do to overcome that. I think stopping is a good start. You know, it's stopping the noise, stopping the endless growth messaging that is shouted at us day in, day out through the media that we consume and, you know, the social channels that the algorithms feed to us. I think noticing. So stopping is the first thing, noticing is the second. Neither of these two cost money, but they do take time. And they do take intention to go slowly, intention to simplify, intention to redefine what enough actually looks like, intention to reconnect as a species and an interconnected one, not just one that is able to operate in narrow silos where we shut our doors and use money as a tool to create black and white. I think we've forgotten how to compromise, we've forgotten how to offer mutual aid, and I think we've forgotten how to exist in a state of reciprocity. And so I think that deep need to slow and simplify and redefine enough for success is pretty critical.
That has just made me incredibly sad just to hear the truth, you know, about what's actually happening to us as a species and in a society. We live in a community, and it heartens me to think that there's people out there like you who sit across so many different spaces. You mentioned in the beginning that you're educating people by writing books as well, and your first book was about homesteading. You've just released Huddle. So what's that all about, and what are you hoping to achieve?
I think future setting came about because it was my way of existence. I had lived like that all of my life, and I had this abundance of skills and tools that, you know, for periods of my life I was actually not ashamed of, but certainly embarrassed by and probably didn't use in a very public way, but began to realise that they were tools that I'd been given as a child because of the way my family interacted as a broader community and swapped and shared and traded and grew the majority of our own food. And so during the fires, my husband was away at fires and he'd been there for weeks and weeks and weeks, and he was caught in a burnover, and it was a pretty sort of catalyzing moment for me where I realized I had skills that could and should be shared with a broader network of people who were deeply seeking this stuff but just didn't know where to begin. And so I wrote the book based on us rebuilding rituals as a species, reconnecting with ourselves and our country and our community, simplifying and growing a lot of our own food if we could, even if it was a pot of mint on the bench. And so, you know, the first book was very much about skills and building a rhythm across a year, across the seasons that are happening in your landscape and with your community, and using the language that makes sense to you. But what I realized was that individual skills in households is one thing, and that's a great place to begin. But unless you actually then come out of your box or your house or your immediate world and seek to find people who maybe have slightly different ways of doing things or different ways of being and different ways of communicating and storytelling and have different backgrounds and different stories and different cultures. Unless we find a way to collectivize and build huddles of meaning, we would continue to trundle ahead in a way that continues to rely on the fat of a fossil fuel system that for the last 40 or 50 years has been readily available to us and pretty cheap. But that's not the reality that we're heading into. You know, we are six of the nine ecosystems having collapsed. We're looking down the barrel of system collapse rapidly. And while it feels pretty business as usual to go to the supermarket and buy whatever you want and get online and buy whatever you want and, you know, live relatively hedonistically because we can, the fat of the fossil fuel system is allowing us to do that right here and right now. What we're not actually looking at is the true cracks to these systems that are abstractions from our ability to connect to the things that matter. And so we need to sidestep ease and sidestep convenience and comfort. And we actually need to put ourselves out on the edge a little bit more and get a little bit more uncomfortable with the reality that we're facing and the truth that we are going to need to connect to one another and to our ecological systems in order to combat complete collapse. And that's pretty bloody confronting to hear. But the truth is we can't do it on our own. And actually, the truth is we're not. There are so many incredible individuals out there doing the most incredible things, lots of them silent and unseen, but incredible nonetheless. And when you actually scratch the surface and find these communities, you realize that the only way forward is going to be in collective ways. And so huddle is about building a tomorrow of togetherness through wisdom, new language, new ways of being, new ritual, compromise, all of those things that we are going to have to get pretty bloody slick at in a pretty rapid way. My hope is that with a book, I can go into communities and begin community conversations because every community is a bit different. The language they use, the tools they use, the community they're in, the acceptance of different ways of being. But when you go into the community with a concept and a way of thinking, and you share that with the community, you get lots of debate and lots of community conversation that stays in that community. So when I leave, that seed has been sown and that community continues to sort of be in that way of thinking in their own way.
That sounds very similar to the ethos behind Sustainable Table, of which you're CEO. What are the long-term goals of Sustainable Table and do you think they're achievable given what we've just spoken about?
I take a really big deep breath for that because I've been in the role for 4.5 years. And so we have three real reasons to begin. And one of them is to grow the regenerative farming systems and practices across the country. You know, we are a very strong agricultural country. And even though the majority of us live in cities, you know, 65% of our landscape is managed by privately owned agriculturalists. And so about 3% of that, though, is managed regeneratively, and that's a very small proportion. But the ability to scale that up and have significant impact on ecological collapse is real. And if we could do that, it would genuinely make a rapid difference. And it would be one of the most powerful and potent and rapid differences we can make. But it's really difficult to explain the complexity of food systems and land management and the cultures that sit behind that. And that is slow and it's based on trust and it's based on our ability to, you know, interconnect our relationships with landscape and with humans. So, yeah, on one hand, it is incredibly powerful. On another hand, it is incredibly hard. So the answer to your question changes on a daily basis for me. Some days I feel immense hope. But, you know, we also work. So that's one of our pillars is to grow the work that we're doing. Another one of them is to enable, and that is through changing the financial sector, which is predominantly extractive, to get them to realise the significance of their enablement if they can shift their way of thinking from extraction to regeneration. But again, that's slow and that relies on trust and relationship building and a huge amount of very steep education that's required to get an extractive system to change their paradigm, to realize that, you know, there isn't always going to be an 8 or a 10 or a 12% return in investments that they make, and that tech solutions aren't the answer, that actually going back to the earth and seeking an understanding of what is needed in the dirt, on the ground, where mycorrhizal fungi sits, where symbiotic relationships sit, where, you know, topsoil, which is rapidly depleting, you know, can be salvaged. You know, this work is slow and there is a massive disconnect, and you referred to that before. The majority of our financial sector is sitting in urban environments where the convenience of food is readily available to them. So the truth of what we're experiencing in our rural and regional communities where ecological collapse is far more visceral and far more visible isn't necessarily available to those who are making financial decisions in urban environments. So can we do this? I don't know. I would love to say yes, we can, and we're making incredible inroads, and we are. We're doing some incredible work with some international organisations and with, you know, a very strong handful of Australian-based philanthropists and investors. But it is but a handful. If we could grow that over the next 2 to 5 years, I would feel more hopeful than I currently do. I think ecological collapse is much closer than we imagine it to be. And I would love to think that the work that our farmers do in stewardship was understood, was valued, was celebrated, had the stories told, and those stories went as far and wide as the stories of celebrities or football players. But the sad truth is they don't. And so getting that cultural shift to really value the most important things, our healers, our teachers and our land stewards, is without doubt the most important work we do, but that just doesn't get seen in mainstream media.
Jade Miles, you're someone who gives me hope, and I'm adding you to my growing list of heroes who've appeared on my podcast of what we teach our children. I would love to reconnect with you and discuss some of these things further, and definitely look into what we could do together to help create a community of people who actually appreciate and value the food that we grow in this country, because by world standards, I think we're doing an amazing job. So thank you for the work you do, and thank you for joining me today.
Great. Thanks, Kim.
CEO of Sustainable Table, farmer at Black Barn Farm, podcaster and author Jade Miles, sharing her vast experience and knowledge about building communities of change and the role of regenerative agriculture in saving the planet. Want to know more about the work Jade is doing? You'll find Black Barn Farms on Instagram and all the links to Jade's podcast and books on her website. Everything you need to know is in the show notes. Why not start your own garden today? If you'd like a book that would help you talk to your children about food gardening, I've got just the ticket. From Mimi's Children's Books, Grandpa's Garden. It's a wonderful story on my website, kimkleidon.com. That's kimkleidon.com. And while you're there, subscribe to our newsletter and communications. This podcast is recorded in Launchpad Studios thanks to Greater Whitsunday Innovation, formerly Split Spaces.